Vlogging the Boys presents Cowboys Radio with Rabs and McCool. Here are your hosts, Rabble Rouser and Landon McCool.
Hello, howdy, and welcome to another edition of Vlogging the Boys Cowboys Radio. I'm Landon McCool, and with me as always is Rabble Rouser. Rabble, tough loss in the Big Easy this weekend, but how's your state of mind right now?
It's actually not bad. You know, I'm hanging in there. I've been working pretty much this whole week on adopting a Buddhist perspective, you know, in which I'm trying to like be like the willow and bend with the wind. I don't want to try to spend energy, attempting to change that which cannot be changed.
Yeah, that always will make for a lot of resentment and hatred in your heart, for sure. We definitely need to discuss what's going on with this team. So give us a little preview. What's going on in the show today?
I think we have a great show for you guys today. We're going to have our special Cowboys at the Quarter Pole episode, since they've played four games. And, of course, our big guest will be the great Bob Sturm, so that's going to be awesome. And then we're going to talk with Alex Shane from Pat's Pulpit, which is the SB Nation New England Patriots site, about the state of the Patriots and what to expect from them on Sunday at AT&T Stadium.
All right, but first, obviously, we should get into our thoughts on the Saints game. So I'll go ahead and let you start. You know, what are your overall takeaways from the game? Like, just having a couple of days to digest it, and we've looked at tape and everything. What are some of the points you want to hit on?
Well, I think the first point is, and this goes back to something that several people were saying when the Cowboys, without Dez Bryant, were getting ready anyway to line up against the Eagles in Week 2, which was, take the team with a better quarterback. And ultimately, on Sunday in New Orleans, the team with a better quarterback won. They had Drew Brees, and we didn't have a comparable quarterback. And not only did they have Drew Brees, but I think this is the important thing, and this is the point that you've made, which is, I think going in, several of us thought, well, they might have a very limited Drew Brees. This might be not be a guy who can really throw, you know, the kind of challenging NFL throws, like the deep out. He might not be able to throw anything, you know, downfield. And in fact, for most of the game, it seemed like he was resting his injured rotator cuff and trying to, you know, mostly throw underneath, and, you know, which works pretty well because their offense actually has a lot of underneath throws. That's one of the things that they've lived on for years. Mm-hmm. But I think you noticed this, and I know I did. When it got down to the nitty gritty in the fourth quarter, you know, he reared back and made a couple of really beautiful intermediate level throws that were right on the money, you know, 15 to 20 yard in the air type throws. And so it almost seems like he knew he had three or four of those in his arm, and he decided he was going to save them for when he really, really needed to make them. And you could see him just rev up. He like used more of his legs. He really wound up. But he was able to make them and make them act, you know, sort of deliver them accurately. So, you know, I mean, what can you do? You're playing against a team that has a roughly equal talent distribution and a Hall of Fame level quarterback who, in fact, was not particularly limited, or at least not in any way that was prohibitive.
And I think that's really, you know, that was really the issue. I think the issue is expectations, and I'll include myself in this heavily, because you know, going into the week, the idea was that, well, this was the winnable game, you know, that before the bye week, that this was the game that seems like the most winnable, obviously, because, you know, the Saints were 0-3 coming into this game. They didn't have Drew Brees the week before. And, you know, so it starts out the week with, oh, we're playing an 0-3 team that's not going to have Drew Brees. And then it becomes, oh, well, maybe it looks like Drew Brees is actually going to play. So, but, you know, he's old and he's injured. He's got a rotator cuff injury. We're not talking like a foot or, you know, something that maybe he could play on. Like, this is his throwing shoulder that's having problems. So, you know, maybe we'll get a severely limited Drew Brees. And then, you know, we kind of get into the game and, you know, he looks a little bit limited early on. I mean, just like you talked about, not maybe unleashing everything all the way downfield and maybe not doing his full complement of throws. But the thing that, again, you know, surprised us, I think, is that I assumed just after seeing that the first half that it was going to get worse in the second half for him.
Right.
That his arm would start getting tired and hurt. And honestly, he got better in the second half. And, you know, ultimately when you pull back and you look at the 10,000 foot view, it's like, well, now we're playing the Saints with, you know, a not healthy but not completely unhealthy Drew Brees, you know, at home. And that's a tough game to win. And especially, I mean, even with your starting quarterback and starting wide receiver and all your starters on defense, that's a tough game to win.
Right.
And, you know, I think obviously the way the game went in the second half, it's sort of similar to the first, and it's sort of for the same reasons. I think it had everything to do with the fact that, you know, our offense was able to manufacture some points, but, you know, we really needed the defense to step up and really, really play well. And by the second half, they were gassed. I mean, they were tired. And I think that they just couldn't make the plays on third downs, especially to get off the field. And it just, you know, if you have such a large QB deficiency, like if the balance at QB is so far out of whack, when, you know, and it was in comparison to an even 85 to 90% healthy Breeze versus Brandon Whedon, you know, you need to win two of the three phases of the game, and they didn't.
And right.
I think, you know, ultimately it became, you know, that like most games in the NFL, the second half, the talent shakes out. You know, that's, I think, where they, you know, they eventually, everything kind of settled in, and New Orleans was the more talented team with all our injuries, especially once Sean Lee went out. It was just another injury we couldn't tolerate, you know?
Right. Yeah. I think that, you know, the story of the game as we remember this is going to be the final play. But the truth of the matter is, if they had managed to win that game, it would have been a miracle.
It really would have been.
The Saints essentially missed an extra point.
Yeah.
And, you know, after the kind of long clock-chewing drive, the sort of inexorable drive, you know, that the great quarterbacks oftentimes engineer against a fatigued defense, which actually, you know, wasn't that much different than the one that the Giants engineered at the end of that game. So in some ways, twice now in the fourth quarter, they've gotten incredibly lucky. One time they escaped and one time they didn't. And that seems about par for the course. So you were just saying earlier this idea that you have to win two of the three phases. And I think that's a really apt way of putting it. And I think the reason they have to do that, and this is something that you said before, either on Twitter or in our conversations, you know, when you have Romo and when you have Dez, your avenues to victory are many, right? There are many streets you can take. So if there's construction on one of them, you can make a quick left, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then like cut to the 7-Eleven parking lot and still find a way to win.
And sometimes you're hopping back and forth between two or three different ways, you know, depending on how the game's going.
But those guys can get you there, right? And then when one of those guys is out, that closes. Like there's like four or five road closures. And then finally, when both of them are gone, you really only have one or two. And one of the most obvious ones is, I guess the other one would be, you get lucky and you get like four, you get like plus four in the turnover margin.
Mm-hmm.
And that aside, which is a sort of rare occurrence, that aside, you have to do exactly what you were just saying, which is you have to win two of the three phases and not lose the other one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so given, you know, the state of the Cowboys right now, that would make us, you know, sort of imagine that the two phases you have to win are our defense against their offense and the special teams battle.
Mm-hmm.
And you just can't screw up on offense.
Yeah.
And the defense lost. And that's, you know, sort of the story of the game. And I think that, you know, something you intimated earlier, but it bears a little more discussion, if for no other reason than the fact that it applies to Chip Kelly in Philadelphia, and that always makes me happy, which is the notion that talent beats scheme.
It does.
You know, I think so many people are on the coaches. Why can't you find a way to get these guys open? Why can't you find a way to manufacture offense? And I'm thinking to myself, if it was that easy to manufacture offense, wouldn't everybody be doing it?
Yeah.
You know, you manufacture offense because you have mismatches. That's the only way you manufacture offense. You exploit mismatches. And if you don't have mismatched players, you don't manufacture anything. And
it's not like they weren't manufacturing anything. You know, I think Bob even will point it out in his article this week. I'm sure we'll discuss later that right now we're producing at almost literally the NFL league average.
Absolutely.
And that should be more than enough for a backup quarterback without his best wide receiver to produce. Like that is honestly, like, as far as expectations level, if you told me that Whedon was going to be playing, you know, two and a half games without Dez Bryant, and we would still at the end of those four games be at the NFL average offense, you know, I would take that 7 days a week, twice on Sunday. The problem is that, you know, everyone wants to blame Whedon because, you know, he's not Romo. And I think that is the one thing that did come out of that late drive that tied the game that took us into overtime, is that I think it at least got some of the people off of Whedon's back of him being the problem. You know, right. I mean, he did a nice job of stringing together some long completions in that drive to score that touchdown. And it ultimately was meaningless because we lost in overtime. But I think, if anything, it showed, hey, this guy can actually do some things, but the problem is that we still have to stop them. And he can't do it at the rate that Matt Ryan and that Drew Brees can. And I think that's, you know, ultimately what we talked about. At the end of the day, talent defeats scheme. I mean, the Cowboys have done an admirable job of handling Brandon Whedon and making him efficient and finding ways to score despite not having a great run game, because everyone's, you know, focusing on the run game, and despite not having great weapons who are winning outside. I mean, that Terrence Williams and Bryce Butler have struggled on the outside, and Street as well. And I think that, you know, Whedon's made it work as well as he can, and I think at an admirable job. But he needs more support from the team, because, you got, with a backup quarterback, I think it should just be automatic. You got to win the other two phases of the game, or it's just going to be a blowout.
Yeah, and you know, so yeah, this notion of being at league average, that seems to me to be a pretty clear indication that you're not losing the other one, especially when you consider that in two games the offense has turned the ball over one time.
Yeah.
So they're protecting the ball, they're moving the chains, they're scoring points, and the defense has given up an average of 32.5 points a game. It's a pretty simple equation. You know, one of the other things that I noticed during the game, and this is going to be giving the Saints a little bit of credit here, was, and this is sort of an interesting phenomenon for people who follow the draft, right? So we spend all this time in the months leading up to the draft researching, you know, oodles and oodles of players who, especially the guys who might be potential scheme fits. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, and then as they go off the board, we think, ooh, that's too bad that guy left. But I'm not really thinking, oh, so-and-so went to this team. Oh, so-and-so went to that team. Oh, that team got another one of our guys that we were really interested in. You know, I mean, sometimes that happens.
It's hard enough to keep track of our guys.
Yeah. And then you'll notice, oh, Seattle got a couple of the guys that the Cowboys really seem to like, because, you know, it makes sense because they have a similar scheme. But you don't, it doesn't, like, the full impact of the fact that, wow, they got six guys that were on our short list. Mm-hmm. It doesn't really, I think, sink in until you see them in the other uniform on Sunday. And so that's actually what happened to me while I was watching the Saints defense on Sunday, is the fact that there were probably five or six guys on that defense, and they're starting six rookies, and there's probably five of them were guys who the Cowboys had expressed some interest in. So there's Bobby Richardson along the defensive line. You got Stephon Anthony, who's their middle linebacker. Huoli Kakaha, who's a sort of outside linebacker, defensive end type. Damian Swan, who is a cornerback. I think those are probably the guys that leap to mind. And all these guys were, you know, we're the type of players who, you know, specialize in quickness. Sometimes they're a little undersized, run and hit linebacker types who I think fit the Cowboys profile. So it was interesting to see them play. Mm-hmm. And it was also interesting to see them play well. I mean, in some ways, I always feel justified in the Cowboys scouting process when the guys who are particularly on their short list of like the national invites and the Dallas Days and that kind of thing play well, especially when they play well early. I think, oh, you know what? Even if the Cowboys didn't get him, they're identifying good players. I feel that way every time I for example, watch Bobby Wagner play in Seattle, because I know he was one of the guys who they really liked, you know, and they would have picked him in the second round in 2012. And so, he got away. But it's a sort of reaffirmation that they were like, we like this guy, and he's a player.
It is always interesting because it's like that surprise. You're like, oh yeah, this guy plays for that team, and then, you know, he makes a play against your team, and you're like, oh yeah, that guy plays for that.
Oh yeah, you know, the other guy was Tyler Davison. There was another sort of who's real sort of low built, quick, you know, got a little bit of pop, and he made a couple of nice plays. So almost every one of these guys made at least one impactful play during the game. So here's the other thing that I think we need to talk about before we bring Bob in, and that's that. I want to bring you back. You may remember this, Landy. I want to bring you back to a conversation that we had about the middle of the season last year, when we had Mike Fisher on for our Cowboys at the halfway mark, and we had a really long And I thought excellent conversation with Fish. And Fish brought up a point in response to a question that we had about leadership in the locker room after DeMarcus Ware mm-hmm. was cut. Because DeMarcus Ware, and to some degrees, I guess, you know, Jason Hatcher in the defensive line room, were the sort of defensive leaders. But they were both really nice guys. Mm-hmm. And you know, it seemed like last year's defense played with an attitude that the previous year's defenses didn't. And Fish said something like, yeah, you give me 22 DeMarcus Wares, I'll give you a Lombardi trophy, but I'll also shake your hand and pick you up after I knock you down. Mm-hmm. And he said, and you know, the word he was using with dogs, and he was saying that Orlando Scandrick and then interestingly enough, Rolando McClain had become the kind of de facto defensive leaders. And both those guys have a lot of dog in them. And in fact, that they sort of saw each other as big brother, little brother. It's sort of odd that, you know, the big brother of the two is Scandrick, since McClain's so big. But they had a kind of little brother, big brother kind of relationship. And they became the kind of beating heart of the defense. And they're both tough guys. They both have a chip on their shoulder. They play physically. And by extension, then, we also talked about the leaders on offense and how Dez Bryant, who's their sort of offensive mirror image, had emerged mm-hmm. as the offensive leader. And, you know, the last couple of weeks I've been watching this team and thinking, those guys are all gone. Mm. You know, I mean, since midway through the Giants game, the guys who were not only these guys great players, I mean, they all have like – they're either Pro Bowlers or they're Pro Bowl caliber type players. And so that's one thing to lose them. But the other thing is – They're the guys who bring the dog that team had last year.
We're missing that grittiness. It's like that ability that when, you know, you guys are tired and you just need somebody to knock the crap out of somebody else to kind of invigorate the defense late in the game, it just wasn't happening. You know, it's like the team is executing the plays but kind of going through the motions without passion. You know, and I think when you see a Rolando McClain hit, it's like it's loud and it's violent, and it's if you're a defender, it fires you up. And you know, Scandrick's passionate, and he like, you know, he'll make a mundane play, but then he'll use it to try to like fire up the rest of the defense. Like, yeah, they're not doing this here. You know, come on. And I think that they certainly, and Dez obviously does that, and I think they really do miss that. You know, I think they are a talented executing group right now. Well, I mean, less talented obviously than before the season started, but they don't have the edge, and that's kind of, I think, been missing in the last few weeks. And I hate using kind of non-specific, you know, kind of very, what's the word I'm looking for, just, you know, kind of hypothetical, not quantifiable terms like that, but the truth of the matter is that it's like momentum. You know, it's momentum is real, it's just not quantifiable, you know. And I think that is the same thing with this kind of edgy dog player, is that what those guys bring to the team is real, it's just not quantifiable. And I'm hoping that you get guys like Hardy and McClain back this week, and you know, hopefully it'll add some of that oomph to the defense, you know, and hopefully change the tone a little bit.
Well, that's exactly why I bring it up now, is because this is the first time we're going to have some dogs on the field since Dez basically went out, you know, in the middle of the Giants game.
Yeah.
And that's what this team, above all, I think, has been missing these last few weeks. And, you know, the other thing to bring up about this is that I think the rest of the players are scared of these guys. Not like terrified of them, but like they don't want to let them down.
Yeah.
You know, like these are the guys that will call out other players. Yeah. You know, I remember in training camp last year, and I don't know if you were there or not, but I know we've talked about this. In training camp last year, the defense, for some reason, had decided they were going to show up as a full unit like a half hour before practice and work on some run fits, I think, because they were kind of going through a walkthrough pace, but they were working on some stuff that like hadn't worked in the first preseason game that they kind of wanted to clean up.
I was there.
And everybody was there. And then Mincy comes strolling out about five minutes late. You know, and I mean, this is still 25 minutes before practice, but he's late for what the defense had agreed. And Scandrick just jumps out of that group and starts tearing him a new one. Mincy, you're always late, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, I remember looking at that and thinking, huh, interesting. Because Mincy, in many ways, has stepped forward as a leader on the defense, but it's Scandrick who is the kind of enforcer. And he's the guy, you know, for years he's been one of the smartest guys in the defense. He knows everybody's position, what they're, where they're supposed to be. And so he's the guy who will just sort of say, hey, you know, do your job, get lined up, let's do this. And I'm not sure how many of those guys they even have now. I think there might be a lot of guys who, you know, they know what they're supposed to do and they kind of do it, but there's no one who's like, you know, a kind of coach on the field. And that, and we're getting a couple of those guys back, and I think that's important.
Yeah, and again, the opportunity to see Lee and McClain play next to each other is hopefully, well, if it happens, yeah, if he passes all his concussion protocol and stuff, the opportunity to finally see that is going to be awesome.
Yeah, I think we're looking forward to that.
Yeah, just a little bit. So, all right, let's go ahead, and before we get too much further, let's go ahead and get Bob in here real quick. But before we do, I want to make sure that we plug Blogging the Boys. It is the fine purveyor of this site and of this podcast, and it's your one-stop shop for all your Cowboys information. So make sure you're hitting Blogging the Boys, you know, before the game, after the game, during the game. Make sure you're hitting the comments section. It's always a lot of fun. For all your information, check out bloggingtheboys.com. Check out their Facebook, Blogging the Boys, and their Twitter, at Blogging the Boys.
It's true. They got a message from the Action Man. I'm happy. Hope you're happy too. I've loved all of needed love. Saw the details fall away. The shaking.
It is my succinct pleasure to welcome into the studio once again the great Bob Stern. Bob, welcome.
Hey, how's it going, guys?
Going great. It's always a pleasure to have you. For those of you who don't know, and I pity you if you don't, Bob is the patron saint of sports geeks. You can hear his musings on weekday afternoons on The Ticket, 1310 a.m., and read his detailed Cowboy analysis almost daily now on the Dallas Morning News. He's been generous enough to grace us with his presence on several occasions, and I, honestly, each time he does, I feel like Chris Farley hosting the Chris Farley Show. I'm always so close to saying, like, remember that one Decoding Linehan post you wrote last year? That was awesome.
I'm beyond flattered. That's really awesome. Thank you.
That was awesome. So you know, it's kind of funny because I was checking who we had on for our like Cowboys at the Quarter Poll segment this time last year, and I found out that in fact you were our guest then as well. And strangely enough, that conversation also followed a Sunday night game against the Saints.
Yes.
The similarities end there, however. So last year's blowout was replaced by a struggle between two seemingly mediocre to poor teams. So things are certainly a little bit different this time around, aren't they?
Yeah, there's no doubt. I mean, what is weird, though, I suppose, is a year ago, after 4 weeks, we still weren't sure if the Cowboys were good or not, and they grew into a really good team. And now this year we're kind of playing the opposite game where there was so many people comfortable using the term Super Bowl in August. And now it does feel like everyone's trying to bail water overboard as quickly as possible to survive this thing until Thanksgiving, when our heroes return on their white horses to save the day.
Yeah, speaking of saving the day and this whole scenario, you know, as a Packers fan, you have some experience with a franchise quarterback breaking a collarbone and being out for you know, an extended stretch of games.
I do.
So can you take a moment and remind us of that history? And I guess even more importantly, having lived through it, what advice do you have for Cowboys fans who are in the middle of it right now?
Okay, and I'll do this from memory, but the 2013 Packers really, really looked like a Super Bowl contender. That was the theory. In fact, their first 2 months, they were pretty much destroying everybody. I want to say at the time of a Sunday night game against the Chicago Bears, maybe a Monday night game now that I think about it, the first weekend in November, I would guess they were 6-2, maybe something along those lines. But they were really running through teams. They had just won a game at Baltimore. They had just won a game at Minnesota, and I thought, wow, this team might have what it takes to win the whole thing. And as it will happen, the great thing about having a franchise quarterback is, of course, you have a franchise quarterback. The horrible thing about having a franchise quarterback is every single play looks like it might be the last one if he gets hit wrong, and you start treating those guys like they're made of glass. Almost baseball players. I'm always, I don't have a problem with baseball. It's a great sport, but it is always amazing to me that every time two baseball players collide, somebody's going to miss 6 weeks, and we normally don't have that problem in football, but with quarterbacks, we kind of do. So I want to say it was Shea McClellan that fell on him of the Bears when he kind of rolled to his right and hit that perfect angle where collarbones shatter. And I want to say it was maybe the AC joint. I'm certainly not a doctor, but I do know that it meant that he couldn't really lift his arm, and it was just horrible. And he was taken off the field, much like Romo was a couple of weeks ago. And from that point on, it was one of those deals where it's a 6 week thing. And then Rappaport even popped on and said the Packers are talking about shutting him down for the season. In fact, I think he actually went with that on one of those Sunday morning ridiculous reports that he's famous for. And, it got to a point where they were playing with, I want to say they started three different quarterbacks during that run. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Tolzien. It was the Iowa State kid, son of a gun. I can't remember. He was with Cleveland as well. And then they finally got around to Matt Flynn. And during that stretch, I want to say they played six or seven games and only won one of them. And oddly enough, that was the game at Dallas, as I recall, where they were down 26-3 at the half or something like that, and really looked like they had quit. And some weird things happened in the second half, and you guys know the end of that story. I think they also tied the Falcons. So basically, after 14 weeks, it was, man, is he ever going to return? Now, what happened and how it's applicable to Cowboy fans is it just so happened that year that the Packers played in a very poor division, meaning everyone kind of thought Green Bay would win the division, but everyone else was going to be, pretty ordinary or bad. And the Packers actually joined them. But the good news is, even though they had seven wins entering the final week of the season, that was still enough to be playing for the division title at Soldier Field in week 17. I actually went to a game in week 16, took my boy up to Lambeau like I try to do every year, and we froze, and it was one of those game time decisions where will he play or won't he play, but it was against the Steelers, and he didn't play. So once again, every boy's dream for Christmas is to watch Matt Flynn in person. So Rodgers did come back for the final game of the season and actually threw a fourth down touchdown pass to Randall Cobb from about midfield in the final minute to sink the Bears and get them a division title at 8-7-1, I want to say. And then the next week they got crushed by a really good 49ers team up at Lambeau in the playoffs. Somehow Colin Kaepernick was once really, really good. So that's what I remember. Basically what it means is, try to play in a bad division that year. And I think that might be happening here. Otherwise, the one thing that's different is Romo has the IR designated for return. So there won't be as much will he or won't he rumor mongering starting like the 1st of November when, someone sees him throwing before practice maybe or something along those lines. Since he can't come back officially since till November 22nd, I think it's quite possible that he might be ready to play when he's eligible. Now, I would not promise that, but I think that timetable is actually reasonably reasonable. And I think if Romo can get back for the Miami game and play those two games in 5 days, I think the Cowboys have a pretty good chance of still winning this division if they can get somehow to four wins by the time he returns and maybe be 4-5 entering that Miami game.
The quarterback you were looking for was Seneca Wallace.
Seneca Wallace. That's who it was. Thank you.
That does seem kind of bleak, but at the same time, that's very reassuring to Cowboys fans that, you know, the Green Bay Packers are obviously one of the top franchises in the NFL, and even with them and with all their great offensive gurus on that coaching staff, you know, one game. I think that's the expectation level has been very high on Whedon to a certain degree. So I think it's tough to win in this league with a good quarterback, and it's almost impossible with a backup quarterback.
Yeah, and I don't think it's even this idea that the rest of the roster is ridiculous or horrible. It's just that you get so used to him being him.
Yeah.
And what we saw from Romo in week one that was just so awesome and really so disappointing that he then got hurt was just such a mastery at the line of scrimmage, just seeing things. We talked about this. I hope we didn't jinx him, but we talked about, you know, the week before that Eagles game that Romo looks like he's finally at the spot in his career where everything is slow and he can just see the play before it happens. He gets them in the right play with his pre-snap reads, and you know, when a guy can do that, to ask his understudy to be able to replicate that in Brandon Whedon's case, it's just impossible and unfair. It really, so little of quarterback play is about actually throwing the ball.
Yeah,
I think that's what we forget, or maybe that we don't know, because why would we? We've never played in the NFL, and certainly never played quarterback in the NFL. And you know, but I believe a guy like Romo, so comfortable in his system, so comfortable in his skin now, that is worth so much at the quarterback position. And before he ever throws a single ball, he just understands where everyone needs to be and handles it so well. And Rodgers obviously can do that as well, but there's a short list of guys who can handle that responsibility and do it well.
So I'm not sure what you thought of the 2015 Cowboys going into the season, but we both held that they were a very good team, and if things fell right, like we talked about, people were discussing Super Bowl contender. So what was your take, and were you as bullish on the Cowboys as we were?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually picked the Cowboys for the Super Bowl back in August, and the reason I did is, you know, honestly, I think of two other teams as heavyweights in the NFC, Green Bay and Seattle. I don't think that makes me incredibly unique with that feeling that those were the three teams to beat. They were the three teams to beat last year as well. And the reason I would give the Cowboys the edge when everything was healthy over the Packers and Seahawks is their ability to pass protect. Mm-hmm. And in a passing league, I really think Green Bay has real weaknesses at tackle, and I think we've already seen that this season. And Rodgers gets them out of a lot of those problems, but I do think there is a toll, a long-term toll to that sort of thing. And even the San Francisco game that Green Bay played this week, Rodgers fell on his collarbone at the exact way and with the exact impact that Romo did and that Rodgers did in 2013. And for whatever reason, his collarbone didn't break this time. Mm-hmm. But it's nothing but dumb luck. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just absolutely dumb luck that he wasn't lost for the season this week because they're asking him to take a lot of hits. And if you watch Seattle play on Monday night, the same deal with Russell Wilson. So I'm a huge believer that this league in many ways comes down to who has the quarterbacks and then who can protect them. And I know that is not necessarily a unique feeling, but I think you can scheme your way around just about everything else, including a mediocre defense. And then, of course, to get Greg Hardy and have a nickel pass rush, that would be Lawrence and Crawford and Hardy and Gregory once this thing gets going. I thought that was going to be amazing, and I think it still will be. So those are the reasons I had the Cowboys in the Super Bowl. I had him against Pittsburgh. Of course, Pittsburgh also lost its quarterback. But now the more I watch, I'm just so impressed with Denver and their ability on defense to just kill you with two great edge rushers and two great corners. So, you know, a lot has changed in a month, as you can tell. But I was absolutely quite bullish on the Cowboys. Kind of thought 11-5 was probably about right. But now that seems but a dream.
So obviously injuries have taken a huge toll, but aside from those, this team hasn't looked particularly good. When we were proclaiming that the Cowboys were going to be excellent, did we miss something?
Well, from a standpoint of
talent, maybe. I mean, like, or do we think that is the injuries just feeding into the larger problems with scheme and inability to beat teams? Just
honestly, I don't really feel anything has changed Cowboys with our evaluation or my evaluation of where they are. I think they are a very good team. I think they are. You know, we talked about this the week Romo got hurt. We had a conversation on our show about the fact that we now know that the running game will stall badly, and it will have almost nothing to do with the running game. It's just the math of football. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that if you're playing against the Cowboys, you now dedicate the troops forward to plug up the run and to make Brandon Whedon beat you. And it has almost nothing to do with the offensive line. I know everyone wants to draw, you know, a connection to Bill Callahan not being here as, hey, this offensive line forgot how to block.
Man, they really do, don't they?
and maybe Callahan could come back and remind them, you know, all the techniques that he taught them. And it's just that's not what it is. Yeah, they're busting a little too often for my taste, but in many cases it's five guys or six guys with a tight end blocking against nine, and that's not reasonable. That doesn't work in the NFL. Maybe Alabama can do it against some of its competition at the college level, but in the pro level, man, if you just dedicate the troops to stop the run, you can do it. You can do it against just about anybody. So the running game was not going to look as good, and it was still going to be they're going to be blamed for it, or Joseph Randall's going to be blamed for it. But in the end, it would have very little to do with them, and way more to do with, you know. In fact, the more I think about it, we talked about this before Romo got hurt, because when Dez was gone, we knew it was going to kill the running game. You know, to go back and to look at this team and say, okay, we're going to take away a top five playmaker in the league, and we're going to take away a top five quarterback right now. And you know, we're going to hope that the rest of the guys can still win games. I just, you know, that just doesn't seem terribly reasonable. I'm not suggesting they shouldn't have won one of these last two games. I am saying that any preseason evaluation was hinged so tightly to Romo and Dez and Greg Hardy and Randy Gregory, you know, and all these pieces. And the good news is Randy Gregory didn't break his ankle. It sure looked like he did.
God, it did. Yeah.
You know, the good news is Dez Bryant doesn't look like he'll be out 3 months. He might only be out a month and a half. And if that happens, you know, thanks be. And, you know, the idea that Romo should be able to return, and if you are going to break your collarbone, let's do it in week two and not in week 11. And so, you know, all these things are bad, but I'm still of the belief that the Cowboys can win this division and be in the playoffs, and it will not be, you know, you're not going to get a bye week now, and you're not going to get home field throughout the playoffs. That seems unreasonable, but I do think to this point things are still manageable, and this is still a really good football team.
So besides doing your weekly Decoding Linehan post, you also carefully study the defense each week. And in the first two games, the Cowboys' defense played really well, keeping the Cowboys in the game despite some fluky turnovers against the Giants and then looking utterly in control against the Eagles. In the last two contests, they have seemingly reverted to their 2012-13 form. What has changed since that glorious afternoon in Philly, or did the Eagles' offense just give us a false positive?
That's interesting. I'm trying to figure that out in retrospect, because at the time their next opponent was going to be Atlanta, and we thought Atlanta's offensive line was probably even more ridiculous than the Eagles' offensive line. And that really struck me as interesting, is when Atlanta started that game, they decided to load up with a fullback for pretty much every running down. Mm-hmm. and just try to ground and pound the Cowboys into a pulp. And in addition, we have to remember there was no Jeremy Mincy. And so the Cowboys basically had one defensive end from their two deep available. And so they're getting Ryan Russell out there, and he's being exposed, and they're playing Jack Crawford out there, and they're just trying anything they can at defensive end. And nobody saw the Devontae Freeman show coming. So that was quite disheartening. But honestly, for the most part, otherwise. And a lot of this hinges on Claiborne really doing a nice job. I'm not sure any of us expected a whole lot out of Mo Claiborne, but he I don't want to say he's been a savior because they've still lost these games, but what a beacon of hope, I guess, for moving forward that this team looks like they might have you know, another corner who is not going to, you know, be embarrassed or anything like that. But, you know, I wrote about this morning for the morning news, and I tried to use a lot of video to show. I'm such a believer in the NFL that so much comes down to turnovers. And again, that doesn't make me unique, but I think it's, you know, it's a stat that stands the test of time. It stands scheme changes, era changes, rule changes, everything changes in the NFL except the results if you win the turnover battle. And what that means, of course, for a defense is we have got to find a way to make a play or two. We're going to get 70 shots, you know, many days, sometimes 60, but about 70 shots to make one play or two plays. And if the Cowboys can get two takeaways, they almost never lose. And if they get none, they almost never win. You know, one is kind of break even. And I was running the numbers today. Since they moved to a 4-3 defense at the start of 2013, the Cowboys played two full seasons in which they had 59 takeaways in 32 regular season games. And so that averages just under two takeaways a game. And you know, obviously during the course of that time, they were 20-12. So they were very, very good. During those 2 years, there were only three games in 2 years where they had zero takeaways. Two times in 2013, they had no takeaways, and one time in 2014, which, by the way, was week one against the 49ers. Huh. Every other game, they got the ball at least once for the offense. And this year, through four games, they have zero takeaways on three different occasions. I mean, that's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
This defense gets takeaways. So what happens when you don't get takeaways? Is that just why is an interception so different than a punt return, Bob, or anything like that? Well, it's simple. It affects your starting field position. And the Cowboys are at the bottom of the league in starting field position. So not only do they have a backup quarterback, but they're asking this backup quarterback to routinely put 80 and 90-yard drives together. Heck, to tie the game on Sunday, he had to put a 91-yard drive together. And I'm sorry, Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady don't consistently score from 90 yards out. Mm-hmm. That's really, really hard. The percentages are so low for 90-yard drives or 85-yard drives. The math just doesn't check out. And last year, the Cowboys were getting every possession started, I think, at their 33-yard line on average. This year, it's like they're 21. And so that doesn't sound like a lot unless you consider that's, you know, over the course of a game, if you have 10 drives and you're getting 12 yards less per possession, that's 120 yards of offense that you have to make up for. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. And so those two things are major, major issues. So what I did this morning is I went through the four games and I, you know, keep careful notes like I'm sure you guys do. And I try to notate every time they have a near takeaway. And I went back and I found seven occasions in these first four games where an interception hit them in the hands, or you guys probably remember Claiborne on a slant at the goal line and against Atlanta. You remember Patman getting hit in the New Orleans game. Mm-hmm. And there were also a couple times where the Cowboys stripped the ball, but the runner was ruled down against the Giants and against the Saints. There was a time where J.J. Wilcox hit Odell Beckham and the ball came free, and they said it was incomplete, not a fumble. And so there were seven times they looked like they had a takeaway, and it just didn't happen. Now, close only counts in in horseshoes and hand grenades, of course, but and certainly not in football and not in takeaways. And I'm sure everyone has close calls, but the point is, if they only get two or three of those takeaways, of those seven chances that they missed all of them on, you know, this team is probably 3-1 right now, and everyone feels pretty good. Mm-hmm. But they got none of them. And their only takeaways this season were all within a 15-minute span in that Philadelphia game, with the Sean Lee end zone interception, a J.J. Wilcox tip ball, and then a Nick Hayden recovery of that ridiculous shotgun snap where Sam Bradford was looking in the wrong direction. Those are their three takeaways this season, and they all happened within one quarter of football. So there's your problem. If you want to, you know, look all over this team and say, what's the problem right now? Why does this team not look right? There's one reason for it, as far as I'm concerned. There's a lot of other little things we can complain about. But the one reason, the one clear reason for me is they're just not taking the football away at all.
Right. It seems to me that one other contributing factor is they're strange in a – maybe it's not strange, but it seems like they're I'll call it strange for now – inability to convert third and short.
Yes.
You know, those two things seem to be what really is keeping them from, as you said, being in the exact same place they were last year when we were lauding them for a terrific start.
Yeah. The third and ones, they're 1 out of 5 this season. And, you know, that's not good. What's interesting is in the Linehan piece this week, the third down is they're, I think they're, I don't know, 28th or 29th. I forget their rank on third down, but it's well below league average. But if they just convert 2 of those 5 third and ones they've had, they're 1 for 5 right now. If they would just convert 2 more and be 3 for 5, do you know their total third down offense goes right to the league average of 39%? So, I mean, it's fun to play with numbers, of course. And like I said, they don't really matter in the end, because you didn't do it. But this team isn't that far off in so many categories. And for the offense, we're all freaking out because Whedon and Terrence Williams look nothing like 9 and 88. But really, they've only gone from elite to average. They're not below average. They're not horrible. They're not disgusting. They're not, you know, if you want to see bad, watch the 49ers offense play. Oh. That's bad. The Cowboys offense, even without Romo and Dez Bryant, is still right at league average. And
yeah, watch Jimmy Clausen against the Seahawks.
Yes, exactly. And that's another great one. Watch Detroit with all their full complement of players. So, mm-hmm. You know, the Cowboys with 90 some points this season through 4 games. I'm sorry, that's not bad compared to a lot of teams in the bottom third.
Okay, so since this is our, you know, what we call our Cowboys at the Quarter Pole podcast, I'd like to hand out some quarter season awards if you're game. Are you willing to play along?
I am, okay. Yes.
So the first award is the Oh, I'm So Ashamed award. And it's to the player or position group that you were most wrong about in either direction, whether you over or underrated them, as you assess their play during training camp.
Okay. I would say what jumps out at me when you first mentioned that is I would say I've been a little bit disappointed with the linebacker play aside from that Philadelphia game. And what that probably means is I got a little carried away with Anthony Hitchens last year and perhaps overrated what he is capable of, at least filling in for McClain. So that and the offensive line does stick out a little bit because although I just told you 10 minutes ago that the offensive line hasn't been that bad, the fact is we did in our dreams still kind of hope that they could do whatever they wanted and you could put a ham sandwich behind them at running back and that ham sandwich would get 120 yards. That hasn't quite happened. So those would probably be the two things that I would like to see a little more of. The other spots like running back and safety, I kind of expected them to disappoint mm-hmm. me, and therefore it would be disingenuous to say they did disappoint me. My bar was pretty low at both those spots. J.J. Wilcox teased me in the first 2 weeks a little bit, but the continuous bad angles of Wilcox and Church, frankly, is a ongoing thing that I really would like to see improve before too long. So there's a bit of a meandering answer on that front, but that's kind of what I'm thinking.
So how about the I Didn't See That One Coming award, which goes to the most surprising moment, either positive or negative, in the season thus far?
Well, the idea of holding the Eagles to 7 rushing yards or whatever it was, that was beyond anyone's wildest dreams. You know, whether you have shorted Chip Kelly stock for 3 seasons now, like I have, and frankly, a lot of this does not surprise you that that his experiment is not going well. I think I called that before he ever coached a minute with the Eagles, that this doesn't seem like it will work at the NFL level. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily the scheme, but the kind of treating professional football players like they're college freshmen. I didn't think that would ever work. And the first thing he did is chase DeSean Jackson out of there. So, but regardless of all of those views on Chip Kelly, his running game does hold water. It does stand the test of time. So to see his running game look so putrid against the Cowboys, and frankly, you know, pretty much every game they've played this season, that's really shocking to me. And you know, I didn't think letting Evan Mathis go made a lot of sense. But for the Cowboys' performance, I would say you could just tell that they spent a lot of time in the offseason examining what to do against those inside zones from the Eagles, and what sort of tactics they could use to cause problems. So that would probably be the first thing that came to mind.
Here's one I hope you can appreciate. It's the Donovan Lewis Award. And that goes to the offseason free agent loss of a strong supporting player that the Cowboys feel most acutely. And the candidates are Bruce Carter, Justin Durant, Dwayne Harris, Henry Melton, Jeremy Parnell, George Selvey, Anthony Spencer, and or Sterling Moore.
Wow. That's interesting, because my first thought is Durant, because Durant was so solid and dependable that maybe it would be pretty awesome to have him at that Sam linebacker through these games. But in fairness to him and in fairness to the Cowboys, he was gone, I think, week 7 of last year. So to say, you know, his performance last year is gone. You know, the one that jumps to mind that they really probably underestimated was Jeremy Parnell. And they mm-hmm. spent so much time trying to find a swing tackle. And honestly, I still don't really think we have found a swing tackle. But just think about all the Darian Weems work in the preseason, the Chaz Green 3rd-round pick, which I can tell you for a fact, there's a lot of nice players that could have had with that pick. And we still aren't really sure that he's a person, since no one's actually really seen him yet. Now they have Charlie Brown or Charles Brown there. And we hope that we don't really have to see him do much more than a tackle eligible tight end. If you still had Parnell, I don't know that he ever would have replaced Doug Free as a starter, because if the Cowboys have been clear about something, it's they don't like to mess with their starting offensive line unless there's a really, really good reason to. But Parnell, man, I don't think we talk about this enough. And I know his bank account appreciates that 6 weeks, maybe more than the fan base does. But the fact that Doug Free was lost, I want to say, in that Colts game last year. No, it was the Eagles game.
It was the Seahawks game the first time.
The fact that they lost Doug Free for that long, including that playoff run, and Parnell was not a major issue at any point, just is – it's really amazing. Because a year ago at this point, none of us knew if Parnell could do anything. And by the end of his Cowboy run, I was pretty much grading him and Doug Free as the exact same person, and basically just pick one. I don't care who, you know, either one could play right tackle for you at a replacement level, starter level. And that's what you want. You just want a guy who isn't going to get you killed. So I think Parnell would have changed the way they saw the draft and changed the way they saw, you know, a lot of the season. It's weird to say that about a guy who wouldn't even be starting for you probably, but I guess I'm thinking outside the box about all the dominoes that had to fall since he left. And by the way, nobody's making the case they should have paid him and kept him at that price, but I miss him. And I think the Cowboys do too.
You know, Bob, I actually wonder if he might not be starting right now because I'm not sure that Free – I'm not sure that Free is right. And I'm wondering if they might – you know, maybe not all four games, but if a couple of those games, if they did have a Parnell, that he wouldn't be in there so that Free's foot can get right. Because I get the feeling like he's soldiering through something and suffering as a result.
I agree. I think that's a astute observation, and I also think that you know, every year, just because he's got a lot of miles on his tires, his performance just drops a you know, half letter grade perhaps every season, which is normal. And you're never going to see drama out of him, and you're never going to see, you know, massive assignment busts that that cost you a game. But just as far as the little details, and that's, by the way, that's what zone blocking is all about, is the little details. And you know, I would say at this point he would probably be a guy that you think you could do better than. But there are so many other problems on this, you know, with health, that that we're kind of ignoring some of these, you know, performance issues like Doug Free doesn't look right, which mm-hmm. I totally agree with.
Okay, a couple more awards. The next one is our Jason Garrett Stay Positive Award, and that goes to the player or position group that has done its job despite trying circumstances thus far.
You know, you asking this question, I would like to circle back to the disappointment of wide receiver, by the way. I should have said wide receiver, huh? Jumping on Hitchens for that question is probably a little bit harsh, because he actually was quite good against the Saints. And the fact that Devin Street and Terrence Williams and really that entire group haven't been able to do more is a little bothersome, even though I'm sure they'd have good stories that we didn't ever look at them, which might also be true. Now, back to this question and the type that the group that has done its job. I'm sorry, my little side road there. I want to make sure I got this right. Restate just a little bit there.
So the player or position group that has done its job despite the trying circumstances thus far.
I'm going to go off the board here and probably annoy some people.
Oh man, I know what you're going to say.
But but I honestly, I really think that the corners have done pretty well, and you know, that the other guy that I'm starting to hear people, and this is really going to sound wrong, because this is if you watch like all 22s all week long, and you say something that is against the popular thought process of the talking heads, then it sounds like you're kind of being an X's and O's bully, and maybe I am, maybe I'm not. I really don't like to hear people say that they don't think Tyrone Crawford played well, especially against the Saints.
Man, he played crazy good against the Saints.
I thought he played really, really well, and I'm hearing people say, you know, he hasn't recorded a sack in this long, and there are no – man, it is not easy for a defensive tackle who's being keyed on to get sacks, but it is easy for him to disrupt plays, and he's disrupting plays. So I want to say that. But going back to, you know, the corner play, I think to understand why I believe the corners are playing okay, you would have to go back and kind of understand what the Cowboys are trying to do scheme-wise. And what they're doing scheme-wise is a ton of cover one. Mm-hmm. And you know, cover one or single high, man under, however you want to call it, man free. The point is you're asking these guys to play man-to-man coverage with limited amounts of help. And I think when the corners have looked really, really poor this year, you know, it's obviously Julio Jones, but I'm not, you know, I'm not the type of person to get mad at guys for not being able to cover Julio Jones or Dez Bryant. That's, to me, that's just unreasonable and silly. And that's like, you know, asking your best defender to check LeBron and then getting mad when LeBron gets 34. Guess what? He gets 34 against everybody. It wasn't your defense. It's him. He's really good. But overall, you know, with Carr, playing probably at about Carr level, which I always think is better than most, because I don't think he's ever picked on or targeted. He's a little handsy these days. You can tell he's not as confident in his skills as he once was, and that it leads to more penalties. But I think Carr is fine, and I would never dream of cutting him unless the cap number just gets prohibitive. And then the Claiborne, the last 2 weeks of Claiborne, or really really the whole season of Claiborne has just been great. And again, I'm not saying he's Revis great. I'm saying he's Claiborne great. It's where my bar was and what he's done. You want to talk about exceeding expectations? Absolutely. Corey White's been nice. And I think teams have gone after Patman repeatedly. And I think Patman trying to fill in for Orlando Skandrick, it's almost like Whedon trying to be Tony Romo. If you thought Tyler Patman, an undrafted free agent, was going to never give up a play, trying to play that Skandrick role, when Skandrick used to be taken to school by Victor Cruz and guys like that, I think your expectations for him are unreasonable if you're not happy with Patman. I think Patman fights his butt off, and, you know, could you do better than Patman? Absolutely. But you can't do better than him for an undrafted free agent making the league minimum. And so I think this corner group, I think they're fine, and I think they're made to look bad a lot by mediocre safety play. but as a general rule, playing a lot of cover one, I'll just go back to the fact that I wasn't sure they could do it without Skandrick, and Rod Marinelli is like, we're manning up. And so, you guys have to prove you can survive on your own. And I think for the most part, they've done a nice job of that.
So here's our last one. This, it may be the same group. It's the Gotta Wear Shades Award. And this goes to the player or position group that gives you the most hope going forward.
I'm gonna go with that front seven, man, and I maybe if you need me to narrow it down further, I'll say that defensive line. But I made some bold claims at training camp that this defensive line could you know make a run at working their way into 30 sacks or something like that, and my projections don't look great right now, to be honest with you. But to get Lawrence and Gregory on the edge and Hardy and Crawford inside on nickel downs. I just think that's going to produce sack after sack after sack. And on top of that, Marinelli likes to use Sean Lee as a rusher way more than any of the linebackers he used last year. So I guess he trusts Lee to know what he wants and the timing of that, and to get in there as a fifth guy and sometimes even sixth with kind of a double A gap look. And I think in nickel downs, that would probably be Hitchens and Lee, but you could do McLean and Lee on early downs. Mm-hmm. I think you can really, really get after some quarterbacks, and they're going to need to. The defense is going to need to steal them a game or two, but I am not willing to give up on this defensive line right now. I believe there's too much talent. I will rationalize Crawford and DeMarcus Lawrence quieter games in that they're being keyed upon. But overall, and I didn't even mention Mincy as a pass rusher. I think now it's time with Hardy's return. And Gregory after the bye week, it's time to really see this thing hum and get a rotation going, keep the troops fresh, and dare teams to double team somebody and leave someone else free. I think, as we get to the cold of winter, this defensive line needs to start controlling games. And can they stand up to the run? Will teams start attacking them like the Falcons did? I'm sure they'll try to, but you can live with that if you're getting a pass rush, and I think I think that's what I'm hoping for down the stretch. And like I said, I'm not discouraged at all through these first four games because Greg Hardy's that good. Randy Gregory is as good as we hoped he is. He's a dynamic, and I don't know if he'll ever be quite right with that ankle injury, but he's the real deal. That's a 10-sack guy waiting to happen in the next couple of years.
So after this weekend's probable blowout against New England, the Cowboys have a much-needed bye week. And historically, this allows teams to regroup and offers them a bit of a objective distance from what's which to self-scout and devise a plan going forward. What do you think the Cowboys need to do during this valuable break, and what do you think they will do?
They need to figure out how to a way to find, you know, more explosive plays on offense, and that might just mean, you know, again, hoping for the health of Dez Bryant. It's just, I never want to give up and shrug your shoulders and say, what are you going to do? But in this particular case, the Cowboys, you know, they let DeMarco Murray go because they knew that Dez Bryant and what he brings to the table is more devastating and more imperative that you keep than a battering ram running back. And so once they let DeMarco go, they knew they were not going to be as dynamic at the running back position, but they were going to try to replace that with two playmakers, Dez Bryant over the top and Lance Dunbar underneath. And I didn't see this coming, but it was clear from the first day of training camp that the Lance Dunbar attack was going to be utilized a lot. And so now, when you start looking at this offense and you just say, hey, what can you do better? What can you work on in the bye week? What can we emphasize more? It's just all of their juice is gone. And that's Dez and that's Lance. And so what you're left with is basically these little dump offs to Witten or to Cole Beasley. And then you're just praying that Terrence Williams can, you know, be on the same page with his quarterback a time or two for a big play. But just where are the big plays coming from? Which is why most of this conversation has centered on the defense. You just have to have players that scare a defense. And I just don't know at any skill position on this offense, you know, who are you circling on the whiteboard when you play the Dallas Cowboys offense right now? And that's, you know, that's the disappointing reality. And, you know, I'm a big believer in any given Sunday. And so I will tune in Sunday thinking the Cowboys can keep this close and try to make it competitive. But the reality is, to keep it competitive against a super offense like the Patriots can be, you feel like you're going to need 28 points minimum to have a chance. And the fact that they got 28 against the Falcons is great, but I would definitely call that an anomaly. I think closer to the truth is going to the 2-minute warning with 13 points like the Cowboys did against New Orleans. And, you know, so there just aren't guys that freak out defenses. And that means you need to put 15 play drives together with 6 yards at a chunk. That's so hard to do consistently. There's just not much. And so Devin Street's been disappointing. Gavin Escobar has not been used again. That's disappointing. Randall has been exactly kind of what I expected. McFadden's kind of been what I expected. They lost Dunbar. They lost Dez. So, you know, I know it's kind of a non-answer because I'm a bit depressed with what their options are offensively, but they're just, unless they're going to work, you know, the Travis Frederick handoff or something, I don't know what's left. I don't know what Scott Linehan can do right
it's
now.
It's an answer, but it's just a depressing answer, Bob.
Yeah, it is, and it goes back though to the fact that this team decided in the offseason to invest in its defense, and they went and got Gregory, they went and got Byron Jones, they went and got Greg Hardy, you know, they went and got Damian Wilson. They invested in their defense. They wanted their defense to be way better. And ironically enough, now we're looking at the defense saying, man, if you can't get us 2 takeaways a game, if you can't get us 3 sacks a game, if you can't get a short field for this offense, we can't win. So please, pretty please with sugar on top, before November 22nd, 2 or 3 times, take over a game. And it might not be against Tom Brady, but it has to start happening quick because, like I said, in my dream scenario where they're 5-5 when Romo returns, or 5-4, whatever the math works out to, the dream scenario involves splitting with the Saints and Falcons, and that didn't happen. So now you're back to, okay, we got to beat Jameis for sure. And then where can we find another one? And that is, we got to split with the Eagles and Giants probably, because you know, the Seahawks and Patriots are probably going to be very difficult. Although the Seahawks game, we should not consider that impossible. It's home. The Seahawks offense is in all sorts of trouble right now, and maybe something can happen there. And like I said, I'm a believer in any given Sunday, so I'm not completely mailing in the Patriots game, but I certainly would not even put a cup of coffee on that.
Hey, and the Cowboys are probably going to have the better quarterback on the field when the Eagles come to town.
Hey, the Eagles could be the proverbial tire fire by then, or they could have a 2-game lead on everybody in this division. As you know, I mean, it's weird that the 1-3 team is still the Vegas odds-on favorite to win this division, but you know, I guess everyone still thinks Chip and Sam Bradford are going to work some magic. So we'll see.
We shall indeed. Bob, thanks so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. Listen, everybody, you have to be following Bob and his fine, fine work. Follow him on Twitter. His handle is @SportsSturm. That's SportsSturm. And you can listen to his musings daily, or at least week daily, on Bad Radio on 1310 The Ticket. And that's afternoons from noon to 3. And as I said, almost every day on the Dallas Morning News, he has some kind of post that usually is the result of some very astute film analysis that's always must-read stuff. Bob, it's always a pleasure. Please come back and join us again, will you?
I always enjoy it, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Bob. Well, every time we have Bob on here, he tops the last time, and I didn't think that was going to be possible, but he did. And he's great and always has the best information, and we're lucky to have him on as a guest.
He's the patron saint of sports geeks.
It's true.
I tell you what, speaking of sports geeks, let's get Alex Shane from Pat's Pulpit in here and see what he has to say about the 2015 New England Patriots.
Now, Alex Shane from Pat's Pulpit joins the show. Welcome, Alec.
Hey, guys. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for joining us. Guys, Alec is a literary agent who loves sports and books. Anyone has a manuscript for the next great horror novel, please send it Alex's way, as well as a former martial arts instructor and stuntman. Wow. Since 2011, he's been with the Pat's Pulpit, where he shares what he characterizes as his, quote, neurotic, off-base, flagrant Patriots homerism with anyone willing to read it. End quote. Since we have nothing but respect for obvious badasses capable of such clear self-assessment, we're thrilled to have Alec here to share his views on the reigning champ. So again, Alec, thank you for joining us. And let's start by talking about the Pats offseason. And just to be clear, we want to steer completely away from Deflategate. We won't even bring it up again. So it appears there has been some fairly significant roster turnover in New England. So tell us about the offseason additions and subtractions, and how have they changed the way the Patriots try to win?
What, no deflated balls jokes?
We don't
really
want to hear it. We're done.
Nope.
We're done.
Wow. This blows my mind. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a respect.
We can talk about actual football. This is fantastic.
It's great.
Yeah. I mean, I think the big question on everyone's mind, in Patriots Nation at least, this offseason was Darrelle Revis is now gone. Brandon Browner asked his release. He got it. And that left them with basically an undrafted rookie, Malcolm Butler, who made the play of his life in the Super Bowl, obviously, but he hadn't really been a major factor in the regular season. That was his first career pick. He was now suddenly the number one corner. They have Logan Ryan, who wasn't a shutdown kind of guy. There were a lot of questions in the secondary. And so that was a huge question coming in, especially with the loss of Vince Wilfork, who also went over to the Texans, and Dan Connolly, the offensive guard, who ended up retiring. So there were some questions along the offensive line, the defensive line, and the secondary. And those were all pretty big areas. But luckily, so far, early at this point in the season, those things all seem to be okay at the moment. But they really haven't been able to change their philosophy too much on the offensive side of the ball because they still have Tom Brady. It's still his offense, and he's the kind of guy where if you are working guys back into the system, getting some new guys in, guys who aren't sure where they fit just yet, he can really compensate for that lack of awareness at the early point in the season with his skill and his high play. And with the tight ends in place and with the receivers still in place, not much weapons-wise changed offensively. Defensively, they were much more man coverage, coverage sack-based last season with Revis and Browner shutting them down. They've beefed up the defensive line a lot. Their front seven is pretty solid, and so a lot of their sacks and pressures this year have come from a stout pass rush. So not much change offensively, at least not yet at this point, but defensively we're looking a lot more of the heavy guys up front and less pressuring on the secondary to cover for 4, 5, 6 seconds.
So we're going to move on and discuss the 2015 season and discuss some of these issues you just brought up in more detail. But before we get there, I want to ask a question that has certainly been on the forefront of Cowboys fans' collective imaginations of late, which is what life is like without the franchise quarterback. And so, we're learning right now it's a pretty scary place. So to extend this to New England, when does the post-Brady era begin and what does it look like?
Yeah, it's so ironic. You know, there wasn't that long ago we were talking about the Patriots backup up against Tony Romo.
Yeah.
Now it's Tom Brady against the Cowboys backup. It's crazy. You know, it's a really hard question to answer, guys, because I feel like every year for the past maybe 6, 7, maybe even 8 years, you get these articles from lazy sports writers in the offseason that say, is Tom Brady's window closing?
Mm-hmm.
Is this the end of the Brady era? You get it every year. Then every year he goes on and throws for 35 touchdowns and 3 interceptions. And so it's really hard to say like when the Brady era is going to be over. He's 38 right now. He's playing at an insanely high level. He's on pace for another historic year. He's got 9 touchdowns this season already, 1,100 yards, quarterback rating almost 120, lights out, and he's playing at least through 2017. That's when his contract's up. But he's also not the kind of quarterback. He's not really a Russell Wilson or a Colin Kaepernick where he runs around a lot, extends the play, takes a lot of hits. He's very smart. He's very careful with his body. I can easily, honestly, see him playing until he's like 42 or 43. I really can. Will that be with New England? I don't know. But at least 2 more years we have of Tom Brady. And after he goes and maybe finishes in San Francisco or somewhere on the West Coast closer to his family, will Jimmy Garoppolo be the guy? I don't know. I'm really trying not to think about it personally. I'm trying to milk every snap out of the Brady era. And when the day comes when he finally does hang him up, it's going to be a very sad day in New England. I'll tell you that much.
Do you think New England would actually let him go somewhere else?
I don't know. It's hard because, you know, Bill Belichick is pretty well known for taking these rock solid, cornerstone, irreplaceable, fan favorite hero guys and dumping them off for a couple draft picks when their contract's almost up to get some value out of them. You saw it with Lawyer Malloy. You saw it with Logan Mankins a couple of years ago. Mike Vrabel left. So there's really nobody that's safe. Maybe Brady's the exception, but I can also see him signing maybe a team-friendly deal at age 40, maybe a 2-year deal, and then Belichick packaging that for a first-round pick to a team in win-now mode. I hate to think about it, but given Belichick's track record, it's definitely not out of the realm of possibility.
Right.
No one can blame you for wanting to milk your incredible Brady years because it's been quite a long run of success. But let's go ahead and talk about the 2015 Patriots offense for a moment. We know about Brady's impressive game and his mismatch problems Gronkowski presents, but what other weapons do the Patriots have, and how do you expect Josh McDaniels to deploy them against the Cowboys?
I think one guy that no one's talking about just yet, but probably will be as the season goes on, is Deion Lewis. Mm-hmm. Deion Lewis he was out of football last year altogether. I believe he was a 5th round pick in 2011 from the Eagles, pick 149, 150 around there. Traded to the Cleveland Browns, played with the Colts for a while, but he really was a pretty much a nobody in the NFL. And all of a sudden, he has 146 yards on the ground. He's got 179 yards through the air. So that's about 325 yards of total offense he's giving to the Patriots so far this year. He's been the number one guy in the backfield at the moment, which is a rarity in New England. Usually, they're very much by committee team. They're very matchup-based offensive when the run game's concerned. And he's been that mismatch guy. He's been the Shane Vereen, the guy that Shane Vereen was before he went to the Giants this past offseason. Deion Lewis has been. He's a matchup nightmare. He's very shifty. He's very elusive. He's not a big guy. He's 5'8", 195 pounds, very, very small, but he can make guys miss. And he presents a matchup problem, especially for those coverage linebackers who aren't as good with the shiftier receivers. So he's one guy the Patriots have added that I think have been a really, really big big impact for them. There also is going to be Scott Chandler on the offensive side of the ball. He's not a pass-catching threat as much as Gronkowski is, obviously.
Right.
But great blocking tight end, huge body. He's part of that four tight end package we can talk about later if you guys want. So he offers some versatility in the run game and the pass game. And since the Patriots already had some pretty solid receivers with Brandon LaFell and Danny Amendola and Julian Edelman, Aaron Dobson is playing pretty well this season. They just traded for Keyshawn Martin. I think Scott Chandler is a great add because he adds a whole new dynamic to an already pretty explosive tight end core.
Yeah, we know all about Scott Chandler. He's one in a long list of really good tight ends who started out in Dallas and left to go other places.
Because we have Jason Witten.
Taking
the snaps, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Can I ask you a quick question about the offense? You know, one of the offense's hallmarks has been its ability to line guys like Vereen, these sort of, you know, multiple players up all over the formation. Are they doing that with like guys like Chandler and Lewis as well this year?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Chandler basically has been more of a blocker, as I said, as opposed to on the goal line, he's more receiving threat. But if you watch Deion Lewis, I'm sure you'll see it on Sunday when the Cowboys play the Patriots, that he's going to line up all over the field. He starts off in the backfield a lot. He motions out wide. You see him lining up close to the line. He's really all over the place. Gronkowski's the same way. Obviously, he's a tight end, best tight end of the game. But the Patriots utilize him like a wide receiver a lot of the times. He'll line up on the sideline. He'll line up in the slot. He'll motion. He'll shift back and forth. You see him in the backfield sometimes, motioning out for like a wheel route. So they really are very good at maximizing the talent they have and lining their guys up in unorthodox places to confuse defenses.
I got one more follow-up too on the offense. I want to talk about that the 14 package, because I do want to know, is he doing it mostly to just try to create mismatches of because eventually someone's that's not capable of covering a tight end is going to have to cover one of the four tight ends that's on the field?
Yeah, I mean, what you're seeing right now is you see Chandler and Gronkowski lining up on the weak side. You see a offensive lineman, a Shaq Mason or Trey Jackson, lining up as a fullback. And then you've got the very large converted tight end, 300-some-odd pounds, 6'6", very, very big dude, Michael Williams, on the other end. And based on the matchup Brady gets, if it's really big, then he motions the tight ends out. Chandler and Gronk go left. Williams goes right. Trey Jackson, Irvin, the fullback, goes up and takes on that strong side tight end package. And he finds a mismatch. There's going to be a big linebacker in there on Gronk somewhere. Linebackers cannot cover Gronk. It's just the way it is. And he throws an easy touchdown. You've seen it almost every time. The only time it hasn't actually worked was against Buffalo Week 2 when Chandler just flat out dropped two passes. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it's been very, very successful. You haven't seen them running out of that package yet because they've gone very big on the goal line. But the real beauty of it is if the Patriots see a matchup where the defense is going small, more cornerbacks trying to match up on Gronk, they'll just run it in. So it's a lot of versatility. I'm sure in the offseason the Colts or Ravens will complain about it. They'll make it illegal. But for this season, we're really enjoying it.
You know, there was an interview with Andrew Gatchkar, who's a free agent linebacker the Cowboys picked up in the offseason, and he played with the Chargers last few years and had to prepare for the Patriots. And he said that they're the most confusing offense in the league to prepare against. And I think that, you know, the element of confusion added to tempo is what makes them so difficult. So when you send four tight ends out there, and you're thinking, who the hell are we supposed to cover? And then, you know, you've only got 10 seconds before the snap to make your decision. You have mismatches, but you have mismatches against confusion. It's a pretty happy mixture if you're a Patriots fan.
No, absolutely. And not only that, they're also very, very matchup specific in how they run their offensive schemes. So what they run week one will not be what they run week two or versus week three, week four. So it's hard to go back and look at game tape and see like, okay, this is what they're going to run against us, because it really depends on your weaknesses as a defense. Right. Very few coaches like Belichick can do that.
And we've only got 3 weeks of tape to look at, so that which seems to exacerbate the problem.
Sure.
Okay, so I'll tell you what. Let's move to the other side of the ball. In the last few years, since about 2012, the Pats have invested really heavily on the defense. They've spent actually 11 of their 13 first and second day picks, that's the first three rounds, on defensive guys. So first part of this is, how are these defensive youngsters developing? And then part two is, what do you expect defensive coordinator Matt Patricia to do, or how is he going to utilize these guys to shut down the Brandon Whedon-led Cowboys juggernaut offense?
You can't even say it without laughing, Rabble. Come on.
Jeez, poor Whedon. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tell right now, because I think the two guys we're most focused on as Patriots fans in terms of youth is Dominique Easley, their first-round draft pick from last year, who had a redshirt year, put him on IR coming off that ACL injury, and then Malcolm Brown. A lot of guys didn't have Malcolm Brown on their draft board because nobody expect him to be around it at pick 32. So he's kind of a question mark for a lot of Patriots fans who don't pay that much attention to college football. And those guys haven't really done much this season. Easley was hurt. He got a hit point during week one. Only has two tackles on the year. So those guys are still kind of the jury's out on them. But there's a lot of upside to both of those dudes. I will say this, though. The third-year linebacker, Jamie Collins, is somebody you should know who he is.
Oh, yeah. We're big fans of Collins. Yeah.
That guy's a monster. 22 tackles, 2.5 sacks already, a forced fumble. And those stats don't even do him justice because he just lines up all over the field. He's an absolute nightmare. I think he's probably the most athletic tight end, athletic linebacker in the game right now in terms of just pure physical tangibles. And he's a real solid core part of that front seven, to the point where actually Jerod Mayo, the team captain, one of the huge team leaders, hasn't seen the field that much. Mm-hmm. Not that he's not playing well, but he just isn't necessary based on the schemes they're presenting. So
that's terrifying.
Yeah, it's just crazy. Between Jamie Collins and Dont'a Hightower is also having a great season. They're doing a really good job in the linebacking core, which is helping that pass rush out a lot as well. Now, in terms of your second part of your question, what is Matt Patricia going to do against the offensive juggernaut that is Brandon Whedon? I think the Cowboys' big strength right now, obviously, is their offensive line. It's still as elite as it was last year. The running game, it took a hit. Obviously, you've got who's your big playmaker that just blew out his ACL? His name escaped me at this moment.
Dunbar.
I apologize. Dunbar, thank you. Lance Dunbar just blew his ACL. He's kind of your electric kind of playmaking guy. That leaves you a little bit thin. McFadden is okay. Joseph Randall's not bad, but it's really all about running behind that offensive line. So I see the Patriots going very, very big on the defensive line. They've actually been doing that. They traded for Akeem Hicks recently from the Saints. They traded Michael Omanawanui over to him. Hicks is a big dude. They just brought up Kiri Thornton from the practice squad. He's 315 pounds. So I think they might even go 4 or 5 linemen, maybe a 5-2 nickel package base, get a helmet on a helmet, stuff the run, sell out on the early downs to stop the run with Jamie Collins, Dont'a Hightower, and force Whedon to win with his arm. And I think if you get to the point where the game is on Brandon Whedon's shoulders and he has to complete passes to another decimated core, your receivers are not really in shape right now with Dez Bryant gone. And no. I believe that Butler's also banged up with a hamstring injury. That leaves you with Cole Beasley and Terrence Williams and Devin Street. And these guys aren't bad receivers, but they're not household names. And so it's basically going to be Jason Witten and a hobble Bryce Butler trying to beat the Patriots secondary. And I think that's going to be a very long day for them.
All right. Well, that leads us to our final question. And, you know, we usually ask our guests to say who we think will win and why. But since those answers appear to be a bit too simple this week, I'd like to switch this up a little bit. And if the Patriots lose on Sunday, it will be because of blank.
It will be because beating the Patriots and Tom Brady, on paper at least, isn't a huge secret. If you can rattle Brady early, if you can hit him hard and hit him often and allow him to not get in a rhythm early on in the game, it's very hard for him to settle. And he gets inaccurate. He gets mad. He gets frustrated. It's happened his entire career. It's always been a weakness of his. So if I am Cowboys defensive coordinator Rod Marinelli, I am dialing up all kinds of crazy blitz packages. I am going all out. I'm playing with house money if I'm the Cowboys right now. Mm-hmm. Like, what do you have to lose at this point? I don't think anyone's really expecting Dallas to win this, which I think is a little facetious, honestly. I think that this is not going to be the Pats have in the bag. The Cowboys have nothing to lose, and I think a team that's nothing to lose can play with a lot of heart. And so if I'm Rod Marinelli, I am bringing the blitz on a lot of downs, very creatively disguised packages. I'm hitting Brady often. I'm going to slam into him. And then when that happens, the Patriots are going to punt a lot, and then it's all about long, sustained drives where you lean on the running game, a lot of high percentage passes, milk the hell out of the clock, and make sure you score in the red zone. I think the Cowboys are struggling in the red zone right now with Brandon Whedon. So you really can't get down to the 30-yard line and under and walk away with three. You got to score touchdowns on those drives and make sure the Patriots have limited offensive possessions.
Guys.
That's all.
Yeah, that's it, right? That should be fine. Guys, if you want to learn more depressing facts about the Cowboys game coming up this Sunday, please visit Alex's site, The Pat's Pulpit, which is our SB Nation sister site. And make sure you're following Alec on Twitter as well. It's at Alec D. Shane. Alec, thank you so much for coming on. And please come back next time we have the good fortune to play you guys again.
Yeah, thanks, guys. Anytime.
Great episode. What do we have for our listeners next week? Or are we even coming back next week?
Well, actually, we're not. We're going to follow the Cowboys' lead and take a week off so we can rest up and get some of our batterings and bruisings healed. And the following week, We're going to have a nice long chat about what's gone on, you know, in the first 5 weeks of the season. And we're going to have our good friend, the great One Cool Customer, in to join us in that chat. So he'll share his opinions on the Cowboys at the bye, share some statistical goodness, and of course his usual insight and be his usual insightful self. So I'm really looking forward to that. Should be a good conversation.
And with the usual German efficiency, I assume.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we got to make sure that we plug Blogging the Boys again before we go. BloggingTheBoys.com is your one-stop shop for all Cowboys information. Make sure you're checking them out during the bye week, see how people are healing up, see what the deal is with the upcoming Giants game after this Patriots game. All your information, Blogging the Boys got it. Follow them on Facebook, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter, at Blogging the Boys. And until 2 weeks from now, happy trails.
Happy trails, y'all.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're together?